You've tuned in to the PDU Podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The PDU Podcast brings together industry experts and seasoned professionals to discuss topics in the assessment and management of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. You can interact with us at pd-u.com, on Twitter at PDU, email us at podcast@pd-u.com, or call us at 716-245-5336.
Welcome to a special edition of the PDU Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Emergency Medical Services for Children Program in celebration of EMS Week. My name is Kyle David Bates, and I'm here with my co-host and Floridian representative, Dr. Lou Romig. Dr. Lou, how are you today?
Good evening, Kyle. Other than a little bit of a cold, I have nothing to complain about.
That is fantastic. So, EMS Week.
EMS Week coming up next week, and right smack in the middle of it on Wednesday is EMSC Day.
EMSC Day. So, real briefly, I mean, most people listen to this podcast understand what EMS Week is. And, you know, I think a lot of people celebrate it by hot dogs and freebies, but it's a lot more than that. It's celebrating our profession. And yes, I am using that term profession because it is. And we're striving to make it more of a profession every day. But specifically, EMSC. Lou, what is EMSC Day during EMS Week?
Well, EMSC Day is just a day to take some time to focus on that very special subset of EMS patients, and that's our very dear children. We all know that taking care of children requires a little bit of a different approach. It takes some different equipment. It doesn't take a completely different knowledge set and a whole different ambulance to take care of. We need to integrate kids into the EMS systems, but they are special, and they require some special attention. So in order to call some attention to that, the federal EMSC program chose to make the Wednesday of EMS Week EMSC Day. Now, personally, I want every day to be EMSC Day, but this is just a day that we take to celebrate that. And for that reason, the Florida EMSC program, in an effort to acknowledge the importance of EMS Week, has chosen to do this podcast, to sponsor this podcast as a service, not only to our EMS providers in the state of Florida, but to all of our listeners through PDU. And because Florida is such a disaster-prone state, one of the things that we wanted to start off a podcast series with is talking about pediatric preparedness for disasters, not only for EMS agencies, but also for general hospitals. And I've lined up just a killer panel for it.
And I think that's excellent. You know, we've over the last year, we've really talked a lot about various disease processes and assessments of kids. So I really think taking this to the next level and talking disaster management is really going to be an interesting topic that we have. So, Lou, you mentioned our panel. Why don't you go ahead and introduce them, because they are actually down there in Florida with you. So why don't you go ahead and do that?
Yes, indeed. And our Florida EMS listeners, if you're acquainted with the EMS constituents in the state of Florida, at the state level, you're going to recognize every single one of these names. Standing in for EMS agencies, but with a great wealth of experience otherwise, is Mr. Jim Judge with Lake County EMS. Hello, Jim. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Lou, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
My pleasure to welcome you with us. And now representing our hospital colleagues, Dr. Rex Northrup. Rex is a pediatric intensive care physician at Good Samaritan Hospital in Pensacola. I got that right, didn't I, Rex?
It's Sacred Heart Children's Hospital, Lou, but thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and be included with this activity.
Sorry about that mistake. We'll get it right the next time. Thanks for joining us, Rex. And then giving us a vast array of experience, both as an emergency planner and as an emergency responder, Mr. Dave Friedman, who is the emergency manager for Orange County, Florida. Is that correct? That includes the Orlando metropolitan area.
That's correct, Lou. I've been the emergency manager for about 8 months now.
And with a lot of emergency management experience in that area, they picked the right guy when they chose you for that job. So we do have the panel heavily loaded for Florida, and We are orienting this discussion toward Florida because we're going to be talking particularly about a hurricane scenario, which is one of our most common disaster scenarios. But there is, I promise, going to be little gems that anybody can pick up out of this podcast, whether you be in Florida, anywhere else in the United States, and even anywhere around the world, because we do have a significant number of international listeners, and we appreciate each and every one of them.
And we were kind of talking pre-show a little bit about disasters, and everyone really gives Buffalo a hard time because of our weather, you know, our snow, which we hardly hit any this year. But the one thing I always tell everybody is, you know, I'll take my cold, I'll take my snow. Heck, even once in a while, I'll take an ice storm. But you know something? It really beats earthquakes, it beats wildfires, and it beats hurricanes on that. And, you know, we don't really have a large number of disasters per se. In our area. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, premise to look at that from the Florida point of view. So I'm way up here up in New York, folks, and Lou and our panel are down there in Florida. And you guys, when is hurricane season? When does that start to move in?
Well, technically it starts June 1st.
Oh, fantastic.
But Mother Nature doesn't always look at the calendar.
Absolutely. So this is something that you guys probably are not too far removed from. This is something that is not an uncommon situation then.
No, sadly not. We've been fortunate for the past few years not to have had a whole lot of storm experience, but it seems like sometimes when we do have a storm, we have more than one storm, and we have a very busy season overall. Now we're getting to the point where it's been long enough that we haven't had a real storm come through that probably there's some complacency sneaking in there again. So it's time to shake things up a little bit.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and shake some things up.
Okay. Our goal today is to try to give a wake-up call to EMS agencies and particularly general population hospitals, community hospitals that are not the high-level tertiary pediatric care centers, to give those agencies a wake-up call as to why it's important for EMS agencies and hospitals that don't ordinarily take care of a lot of kids to gear up to be able to take care of a lot of kids in the case of disasters. Because we can't always rely on our usual resources to take care of those kids in a disaster. Sometimes those resources become unavailable. And if you don't have the plans to be able to handle an unusual pediatric load, and we're talking beyond an MCI protocol, we're talking beyond a bus crash here. If you don't have the plans to deal with those kids when your outside resources aren't available, boy, you're going to be behind the eight ball and care is going to suffer. And you're not going to be able to do the job for the kids or for their families, which means you're also not doing the job for your community. So what I would like to propose, gentlemen, is a scenario. And in the scenario, it's Labor Day, and we have Hurricane Kyle. Ha, ha, ha. Hurricane Kyle was a Cat 2 as he approached the east coast of Florida, long about the level of New Smyrna Beach, but very, very quickly intensified to a Cat 4 just prior to landfall. At landfall, his winds were 135 miles an hour. Hurricane force winds extended to a radius, that's a radius, folks, not a diameter, a radius of 55 miles, with tropical storm force winds of 160 mile radius. So we had that rapid intensification just prior to landfall, so we had much more of a storm than what we anticipated we were going to have. So the storm hits on Labor Day in the early evening, proceeds to go across the state westward, crossing at New Smyrna Beach, making landfall there, proceeding westward, maybe a little bit south of Westford, at about 11 miles per hour, and proceeded across the state and then exited out the west coast into the Gulf of Mexico, still at Category 1 status. So, of course, with a Cat 4 storm, we have a lot of damage. We have a lot of wind damage. We have coastal flooding. We have inland flooding. And in addition, particularly because of the rapid intensification just prior to landfall, there is a high percentage of tornadoes in Hurricane Kyle. So any of you who've been involved in a hurricane, who've seen what it looks like when a hurricane crosses through, or a tornado, knows that this can be truly, truly devastating kind of circumstances. We're coming across the state now with this devastating hurricane, crossing into an area that is a very largely touristed area. The metropolitan Orlando area has been involved. the major theme parks have been involved, and you know that there were a lot of tourists there because this is Labor Day and it's the last blast of summer. So there is a swath of devastation that's cutting across the state, going from New Smyrna on across to the West Coast, and primarily in the eastern half of the state. Now, unfortunately, the major pediatric hospitals and the major trauma hospitals in Orlando are either partially functional or not functional at all. And that includes Orlando Regional Medical Center, the Trauma Center, excuse me, and Arnold Palmer Children's Hospital, who is a primary tertiary care referral center in Orlando. A lot of hospitals have been involved and have limited functioning. So that's our scenario. Anybody got a little bit of adrenaline going yet? This is something that we hope not to see, but we hope not to see Katrina either, and we had to deal with her. So let's start with the EMS response. Jim, given that kind of a scenario, what kind of things are going through your head from an EMS standpoint? How do you think EMS agencies right now, for the most part, would be prepared to deal with that scenario, keeping in mind that we're focusing on the kids?
Well, Lou, right now I'm not sure if it's adrenaline or an anxiety attack, because obviously the scenario that you came up with is obviously going to be tremendously devastating to the state of Florida, not only from the coastal communities where you're going to have significant storm surge. Obviously there's going to be a lot of evacuation, and you're talking about as many as 8 counties across the state being significantly impacted. Hopefully that there were a lot of pre-planning done across all of these counties for a worst-case scenario. And, of course, what we always prepare for, that if a storm is going to come in at, say, a Category 2, we always try to plan for a Category 3. But, of course, this one came in as a Category 4 at 11 miles an hour. Obviously, it's going to carry those winds, and those hurricane-force winds, not only completely inland, but even exiting out of the Gulf Coast as a Category 1. So there are going to be road access problems. There's going to be power outages. You're going to have debris. Certainly there's going to be tornadoes. You're talking about the evening hours. So it's going to be extremely difficult. Back when we had the 2004 hurricanes, we had Francis, Jean, and Charlie all come across Central Florida. And several of those, of course, were in the nighttime hours. And we did try to deploy resources out. And, you just can't see. All you have is the headlights on the vehicles because the power's out. So it is an incredibly dangerous situation. And, what you try to do at that point is to try to communicate what damage is taking place within the community. Everything, as David can tell us, is going to go through the Emergency Operations Center. So here in Lake County, we're going to be communicating everything we can from our outlying fire and EMS stations, also from law enforcement, to be able to give damage assessments to the Emergency Operations Center. Also, our Emergency Operations Center is going to be coordinating and talking to, from Volusia County to Orange to Seminole, over to Hernando, Pasco, Citrus, Sumter. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of communication that's going on. Also, given the size of this storm and the intensity, what would normally happen would be to pre-deploy resources, close to the area, but right out of harm's way so that they could be called upon to respond for assistance. And then, of course, we're at that point already going to have quite a few individuals in shelters. So you're talking about a significant event that, once the winds died down, we're going to have to go back out into that weather, do search and rescue. Obviously, we have a lot of mobile homes all the way from the East Coast through Central Florida to the West Coast. So lots of search and rescue. There will be requests for out-of-area resources. We're going to be looking for the state to declare a state disaster. We're going to be looking for the federal government to also declare a state of emergency, because once we have the state and federal declarations, then we're able to not only use state resources, then we're also able to go after those federal resources. And, what you've described, we're certainly going to be calling our state partners as well as out of state. I would imagine that as a storm like this came in, we're going to have some DMATs. They're going to be posted nearby. And then it's a matter of damage assessment to determine, you know, what's going on out of the community, the type of damage, and then also looking at our hospitals, our nursing homes, and assessing possibilities of having to do evacuation, mass evacuation from these medical-type facilities. And then also, you know, making sure that we have adequate resources and that we've done all of our preparations to be able to, you know, to go back and respond to this type of an event. But this is going to be a multi-day response. It's certainly going to be months and months, if not a year, for recovery. So there's a lot that's going to go into this. And, of course, you know, we're talking about kids. So, you know, when we do our pre-planning, you know, this time of year, obviously we want to plan when it's sunny out. We want to look at everyone who's registered for special medical needs, and we want to look at all age brackets. You know, everything from the very young to the very old and everything in between has the possibility of showing up at these shelters. And, you know, over the hurricanes that we had, again, Charlie, Francis, and Jean, we probably, over the three hurricanes, sheltered over 1,200 people that had special medical needs, and a lot of those were kids. But a big part of that is making sure that, you know, you adequately plan for the medical supplies to not only care for the elderly, the oxygen dependent, with your medications, but also for children's needs, because they're certainly a part of the community. And, you know, if you prepare and you plan ahead of time and you're working with your local emergency management office, you're going to be so much ready to be able to handle those people that are in the shelters, but then also those that are going to need shelter after an event like we're talking about.
Hey, Jim, you know, your EMS systems have been, you know, very widely reputed for their excellence in all aspects of response, including your disaster response and your disaster planning. But do you think that the majority of EMS agencies really, really think and plan for having to deal with an unusual pediatric load in the case of disasters?
No, I don't believe we do. You know, I can remember back, as Dave and you will remember, and I'm sure Rex, you know, back in 1990, Dr. Robert Luton came up with a program called the Year of the Child. And if you recall back then, I know in the state of Florida, we weren't really doing anything as far as carrying pediatric equipment, pediatric medications. And, you know, of course, with the work that you've done, Lou, and many others have done, you know, with the Jumpstart Triage program, with all the different products that have come along, I believe that the state of Florida, and I believe many EMS providers across the country, you know, are equipped somewhat to be able to handle the pediatric patients, the child emergencies. But, you know, when you have a mass situation like this, I believe that it's going to be a huge impact. And also part of the issue is the budgets. I mean, you know, there's so much we can do right now just trying to keep the wheels on the vehicles and provide the services to handle the call volume that we have. So, you know, planning for and equipment and things that go beyond, you know, just the normal staffing, the normal training is very difficult right now. You know, we hope that in the future there would be grants and additional things available. And, of course, here in the state of Florida, as well as across the country, you know, we have the pediatric advanced life support training that I remember taking that class. I think it was back in 1988. So I know I'm getting old here, but, you know, the program has been around for a long time and still continues to be a wonderful training program. But this would be a huge event. It would have, you know, all the EMS services within the impacted area scrambling to be able.
Okay, Jim, you're dropping.
Jim lost you.
Yeah, Jim's dropping.
And talking about the training that's available out there for pre-hospital medical providers, of course, the pediatric advanced life support course is wonderful. And, you know, we began teaching the class back in 1988 and is still an excellent class today. But again, given the scenario, Lou, that you've come up with and how devastating it would be for each of the counties would be obviously scrambling to do search and rescue, open up additional shelters, bring staffing in, bringing medical supplies in to be able to care for not just pediatric patients, but people of all ages. And it reminds me back in Hurricane Andrew when I was down
of Florida City, and we had a small community center that we set up with a DMAT out of North Carolina, and we were desperate for pediatric medical supplies. And what we were told was there was a building about a half a mile away that was absolutely destroyed, but it was a pediatric care center. We went down. We were able to dig through the rubble. We brought back an incubator, medical supplies. You'd be surprised what we found. But obviously, that's not the way you want to go about it. So within our communities, we need to certainly recognize the pediatricians, the clinical experts, the areas that we can go for additional equipment, medications, and supplies that may be over and above what we had planned for, given, you know, such a large scenario.
Now, I just want to step in here for a second, Jim, you know, on a comment that was made. And, you know, I agree with you that, you know, equipment-wise, I think we're a little bit more prepared for, you know, dealing with the pediatric patients, but I think psychologically we're not. I still find through all the pediatric education I do throughout the country, I still find there's a big uneasiness when it comes to kids. I think, you know, equipment wise, you know, we're there, but being comfortable or confident in treating kids, EMS providers are not there and are nowhere close to it from what I see.
I would agree with that, Kyle. And let me tell you what I think we need to do to solve that problem. We need to have EMTs and paramedics involved with the care of children on a regular basis. And let me tell you an experience that I had when I was the director down in Indian River County. We actually partnered with the Indian River County Health Department, and we provided childhood immunizations. We started out with six paramedics, and, you know, over the years, we immunized over 10,000 children, and we had regular access to kids. And, you know, when you have parents, you know, who are EMTs and paramedics, they realize that the kids are pliable and you're not going to hurt them so much. But when you have a young EMT, young paramedic who's never been around kids, they're terrified. And of course, if you ask any EMT paramedic what their worst call was, it's always going to go back involving a pediatric patient. So the way to fix that is to find ways to integrate your EMTs and paramedics into regular visits, you know, whether it's working with the local pediatrician office, assisting with immunizations, whatever it is you can do to get your medical personnel dealing with pediatric patients. They're going to become more comfortable, in not only assessing, but drawing blood, starting IVs, because it's going to be something that, again, when you do things routinely, then they become routine. A pediatric patient is not a routine. So when those calls come about, you know, there's a certain fear factor that goes on into it. And so that is one way. And Lou, you might want to comment on that from your experiences. But again, my experience has been that the more you can put those EMTs and paramedics in touch and working with your pediatric patients, the more comfortable they're going to be in the care and treatment.
And, you know, Jim, I can't agree with you any more than I do. And, you know, in the context of disaster planning, there are ways that we can get our EMTs and paramedics interacting with the kids. And I think not enough EMS agencies take advantage of the child care and school agencies in their communities to get that kind of an experience. And it can be a two-way street. You know, the EMS agencies can come and help the schools with their disaster plans. On a national level, the National Commission on Children in Disasters identified that daycare centers and other non-school child care centers are particularly at risk and particularly underprepared. Wouldn't it be great if EMS agencies would partner with their local daycare centers as well as their local public and private schools to help them with their emergency planning? And then at the same time, by doing that, by actually going physically to those agencies and interacting with the kids and doing drills with real children, you know, how you know, that's killing like 10 million birds with one big stone. You know, the schools need the drills. The EMS agencies need the drills. Some of the best disaster drills can be done with live kids. And particularly in the middle and high school ages, they all need some kind of public service hours. And it's not uncommon, particularly for the children's hospitals, to utilize children from the local schools as disaster victims. It has to be done in a certain way with certain precautions. But it's a great way to get the EMTs and paramedics exposed to the kids, to get the kids exposed to the world of disaster response, disaster preparedness. And that's one way that I think that we can help to overcome that unfamiliarity hurdle while helping everybody to be better prepared for kids. Jim, let me ask you just one more thing. If our listeners want to go back to their EMS agencies and try to find out how well their agencies are prepared for kids, and keep in mind that we're not just talking about, again, the bus crash, the multiple casualty thing. You know, if you have a multiple casualty incident, you go through START, hopefully you go through JumpStart or some other kind of pediatric-specific triage system, and then you think you're going to get those kids off of your hands, transport them to the local hospitals, and then you don't need to deal with the kids. But are those EMS agencies prepared for times when they might have to have prolonged patient contact with very badly injured kids in some cases, although a lot of them will be maybe slightly injured, and not be able to just shove them off on somebody? Maybe the local pediatric capable hospitals are operating above capacity already, or they're non-functional because of the disaster that just went through. So what can our listeners do to go back to their EMS agencies to try to find out how prepared their EMS agencies for that kind of a scenario? What should they be looking for?
Well, great question. Certainly to be able to go back and look at the local policies, protocols, but more importantly, what I would steer them toward is every county has to have a comprehensive emergency management plan. In that plan, there's a litany of information about preparedness, about response, recovery, mitigation, and there's also annexes. And then if you go to the emergency support function areas, of course, ESF 8 is health and medical. To go to that that comprehensive emergency management plan and see what it lists in there as far as disaster response, how EMS is integrated into that comprehensive emergency management plan, and really that's going to be a wealth of information there, because when the local emergency manager, like Dave Freeman, you know, works to put together and update his comprehensive emergency management plan, he's going to be working with fire, law enforcement, EMS. I mean, there's a multitude of agencies that are going to have input into that plan, and there's going to be sections for each one of them and how they respond, and it's going to be laid out pretty well. So, David, would you agree that the CEMP would be the place to go?
Absolutely. That's a very important plan that we work on and solicit a lot of community input into the plan to make sure that it will actually be an operational plan should the need arise.
Okay. I got to step in here and ask a couple questions here on this. Plans are great. Plans are wonderful. They're nice. They're thick. Lots of writing, lots of paper, lots of ideas. But when this disaster actually hits, especially at the magnitude that we're talking about, you know, today, on this, your plan staff are not all going to be there. They're going to be dealing with emergencies at home. You're going to have roads that are impassable. They're not going to be able to get in. They may be injured or victims themselves. So how do you deal with that, Dave? How do you actually go ahead and take this from being this huge, great plan on paper to actually start to actually enact it, based on the aspect that you may not have half your staff?
Well, most of the agencies that we work with, all of the hospitals that we work with, are required by Joint Commission to have a disaster plan for their hospital that takes all of this into account, and they're expected to exercise it at least once a year, and most of them exercise it twice a year. So they understand the ramifications of loss of power, loss of access to their hospital, and they pre-plan and bring in extra staff prior to the impact of the storm so that they have enough staff on site to be able to manage through the impact and the immediate aftermath of the impact. So that's one part of this. The other part is that in many of the hospitals that we're dealing with that have large populations, part of the requirement that the state has is that they have mutual aid agreements with sister facilities outside of their immediate area. And if they are anticipating an impact, they will begin to discharge all of the patients that can be discharged so that they're not having to deal with them. And if they have to move them, they will move them to their sister facilities prior to impact. So they're trying to reduce their census as much as possible to also reduce the requirements for providing care during and after the disaster.
But now we have a disaster here that's been proposed that rapidly intensified and caught people off guard.
Well, we're hoping they won't be caught off guard because we have very good predictive tools that we use. And believe me, we're watching this storm while it's still out in the Atlantic. And we are anticipating and using all of the tools that the National Weather Service has to make those determinations. The other way that we can help with this is to have shelters available to move clients into if the hospitals are damaged. And we have a plan in place with both our transportation agencies as well as our EMS agencies to affect that move.
Now, and that's the one thing that we found out. I found out here a lot of our hospitals up in this area. I live in an area that is one of the top areas for chemicals and some really nasty stuff in the area. So a lot of our hospitals actually involved the local EMS and local fire into their emergency plan. But the problem that's going to happen, though, is if something were to happen at one of those facilities, all those folks are going to be at those facilities. So you're talking about the hospitals, you know, utilizing the EMS and transportation systems of the local areas to help transport patients. Well, they may be out running emergencies. They may be out dealing, you know, with that. This hospital could very well be left on its own. How do you plan for that?
Well, you're assuming that we're only talking about ambulances, but we're also talking about the paratransit agencies that are moving the transportation disabled or disadvantaged or the disabled community on their daily transports. And in the Central Florida area, we have of 17 paratransit agencies that do nothing but move people between their doctor's appointments or their dialysis treatment. And then we have another 15 that are routinely moving between nursing homes and congregate living facilities and so forth. Those are all be brought into our plan. They're all part of our plan and are exercised. And those are the ones that we'd be using to move these patients, leaving the EMS agencies to run those emergency calls.
What about the use of city buses and alternative transportation?
Sure. City buses are part of the solution as well, as are taxi cabs. We invoke all of our transportation assets as part of our plan. They are part of our planning effort and are part of our response. We also will use some of the more non-traditional methods. We have a capability to transform city buses into stretcher buses, where we can put in rapidly installed devices that will allow us to bring in litters and actually be able to move patients that are not able to walk out of the area. So we have those kinds of capabilities that we've been able to develop as well.
Hey, Dave, let me ask you a question, and then I want to make sure that we have time to get over to Rex. In your plan for Orange County, how do you incorporate children and families into the plan? Do you have a separate pediatric plan? Do you incorporate pediatric and family issues into the general plan? Do you treat them as a quote-unquote special population? Or what do you do in Orange County?
Well, pediatrics are just part of our planning process. We include them in our general population considerations as well as those pediatric clients that may have some special or functional needs that have to be met. We work a lot with our community partners, both from a service delivery perspective as well as from an advocacy perspective. And we want to make sure that we're addressing their needs both in the educational realm, where we're trying to educate them so that they can be prepared themselves or their families can be prepared to support them, but then also to educate the responders on what those special needs may be or those functional needs may be so that they can anticipate and be prepared should the need arise.
And Lou, can I jump in?
Yeah, sure.
You know, Lou, one thing that I want to bring up that David touched upon, and a lot of it comes down to personal preparedness. You know, Lou, you and I serve on the Red Cross Scientific Advisory Council, and we do a lot of work through the Red Cross to try to educate the public, but really, personal preparedness, you know, having those items at home, having that first aid kit, neighbor helping neighbor in an event like this is really what's going to get the job done until we're in a position to be able to respond, you know, with public safety to be able to go out and do search and rescue and find the individual. So if you're told to evacuate and you're in an evacuation zone, evacuate. You know, don't wait till the storm is, it's windy and rainy to try to run down to one of the box stores to get your provisions and then try to get on a ladder to put up shutters. It's not going to work. So really, individual responsibility, individual family planning, making sure that you have all the things that you need in order to weather this type of an event. You know, there's a tremendous amount of information out there on what people could do, what they should do. But again, the more that individuals prepare, the better it's going to be for everyone. And certainly, as we try to go out into the community to try to respond after an event like this, it's going to be time-consuming. You know, it might, you know, be, you know, a day or so before we can even get to some of the most affected, depending on the debris and the wires and all the different things. And of course, Lake County, for instance, we're 1,100 square miles. We have a lot of urban, suburban, but we have an awful lot of rural areas that on a sunny day, you know, could take you 30 or 40 minutes on dirt roads to access people. So, you know, I just want to throw out there the personal preparedness, and I'm sure David would agree with that.
Yeah, we can't emphasize that enough. Preparedness begins at home. And, you know, our esteemed alumni, Craig Fugate, who now is the head of FEMA after heading up Florida Emergency Preparedness for a while, really has leaned on family preparedness as the cornerstone of disaster preparedness. And I often say that the family is the smallest unit of survival in a disaster. And the more a family can rely on their own resources and those of their support system, the less they have to rely on the federal and the state resources that come in. And I would also add that when we're talking about people who are so dedicated that they are leaving their families and working with their EMS agencies, working with their hospitals, working with their emergency management professionals during and after a disaster, we need to help them to help their families prepare, because they will work longer, they'll work better, and they'll work with more intensity if they're comfortable that their families are safe. So one of the best ways for an EMS agency to plan for disasters is to help their employees plan for disasters on a family level, on a personal level, so that those of us who are the first responders and receivers can feel comfortable enough that our families are taken care of so that we can stay and do our jobs. And Dave, I'm so glad to hear that you address pediatric issues in your general population planning. You know, for a long time, children have been put into the quote-unquote special needs or special populations category. And one of the things that the National Commission on Children and Disasters and some of our other pediatric advocates on a national level have tried to do is try to get away from thinking of kids as a special population, because they're not segregated in the communities. They're right in there with all the adults. And just as we have to integrate our EMSC system into the larger EMS system, children are integrated into our communities. So we need to plan for them in our integrated emergency plans. It's all too tempting to say, okay, we're going to really work on our general plan first, and then when we have time, we're going to address our special populations. Well, we can't afford for children to be put in those little niches. We need for them to be planned for in the main part of the integrated community planning. Now, yeah.
Now, I will say, though, that when Jim was bringing up the aspect of evacuation stuff, and Lou, you're talking about, you know, putting kids not into special populations, I think we have to look for, you know, or talk briefly upon the aspect of children with special health care needs, you know, on that, you know, these vent dependent kids who are dependent upon electricity and power. And that may be something that the local agencies want to make sure they know who in their community are these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are community EMS agencies who can pinpoint where every identified special needs patient is in their community, where they spend the majority of their time, and what their special needs are. And I think the more communities that can adopt that kind of a system where the responders are familiar with those who have those added vulnerabilities, and they know that in their territory, they're you know, there's Mrs. Brown and little Jimmy Jones and whoever else, and can help them, number one, to prepare, and then number two, be aware that they need to keep a special eye out for them and try to anticipate their needs and help them immediately afterwards. I think that's just an important part of an integrated plan. And again, you know, if we just separate off these special populations people, sometimes it seems like an afterthought, but they are a vulnerable population. And gosh, you know, who could be more vulnerable than a very young child with special health care needs or a very elderly person with special health care needs? And their families are not necessarily always going to be able to meet those needs. So we need to plan to anticipate those needs, take action before a disaster, and even before that, help those families to plan what they're going to have to do so that they can do their part.
Dave, would it be wise for local agencies to actually go ahead and do a community survey to see who's out there, to see what children are out there that have special health care needs, and actually go and sit down with the families and start pre-planning evacuation if it's needed?
You could do that. That would be very labor intensive. However, I think a better solution is to partner with the community groups, the advocacy groups that are out there working with this population, and also with the agencies that are working with these populations, and have them do that outreach and that education to provide information and education about the EMS response capabilities and how they can prepare their families. I know one of the things we've done in Central Florida, especially in the Orange County area, is we have all of the identified service providers that provide services to these special populations of children that we meet with on a routine basis. We review their plans, we discuss their outreach, and we also register their clients into a registry, which allows us not only to provide information prior to a storm to the families and this special population, but also when we are going to be opening shelters, to notify them when the shelters are opening and if they need transportation assistance, to schedule that transportation. We also provide that same information to the EMS agencies and fire agencies so that they can, after the storm, if they did not evacuate, they can actually go out to their homes and check up on them to make sure that they're okay. So I think that you really have to take a very broad perspective on this, but you've got to include your community and your community partners, or you'll never be successful.
I'd like to kind of refocus now. Let's go back to Hurricane Kyle. You know, we've been talking about how EMS agencies can and should plan for more than the usual, you know, small to medium-sized multi-casualty incident involving kids. Granted, that's going to be the most common. Bus crashes are common. Even in the bus crashes, the majority of kids are not seriously injured, so there's not a whole lot of exercising of a pediatric multi-casualty plan on a regular basis for many agencies. Let's refocus now. We have this wide swath of damage. EMS agencies are going to be responding as well as they can. Hopefully they've planned in advance to be having to take care of children and families, and they're planning for what they're going to do for triage of children and how they're going to recognize that families are going to want and need to stay together. So if you have an adult who's a red and a child who's a green, are you going to try to take that child away from that parent and transport that parent someplace and then leave the child without, you know, family member there? You know, there's a lot of little ins and outs and finesses that need to be thought about and really should be thought about before a disaster ever happens. You know, you could have large numbers of unaccompanied kids that you're going to have to deal with and figure out how you're going to do the paperwork and assume responsibility and that kind of thing. Those are all little details that really do need to go into a pediatric emergency disaster, or, you know, a disaster response plan for EMS agencies that go beyond just, okay, can we triage in red, yellow, green, or black? So we have the EMS agencies who may or may not be well prepared to take care of these kids. We have a lot of hospitals in the swath of Kyle's damage that have limited functioning or not functioning at all. Jim, how many hospitals do you have in Lake County, more or less?
In Lake County, we have three hospitals.
Okay.
And
How many?
You know, our closest trauma centers down in Orlando. But if you know, with what you've described with Hurricane Kyle, chances are we would be you know, going up to Shands and hospitals to our north. Obviously, what you said, anytime we have a pediatric patient that is injured and needing transport, we always try to accommodate a family member everywhere we can to go with them. You know, even if it's in a helicopter and there's room to put that family member or to try to assist them in getting to that facility so that they can arrive not too long after the child gets there. But obviously we want to provide the quickest and the very best care we can.
But it needs to be thought out beforehand. And
absolutely.
Somebody needs to be running potential scenarios through their head and going, what if, what if, what if? Now, Dave, how many hospitals in Orange County?
We have 8 hospitals in Orange County with 2 under construction, including a new pediatric hospital.
Right. Okay. So, and then Seminole County will have been hit. Volusia County will have been hit. So a lot of hospitals will have, you know, some adverse effects. And many of those hospitals, I think particularly the smaller ones, maybe the ones in the more rural areas, may have to deal with kids on a daily basis, but have relatively limited pediatric capabilities and on a daily basis plan to be able to transfer any really sick kids out to the pediatric tertiary care centers, whether it's in Orlando or further north or even south. So now we have a situation where those referral centers, A, either are not up and functioning, or B, you're not going to be able to get pediatric patients out because of problems with access into the area. So those hospitals in the area that still have some functioning left and don't have new resources coming in yet are going to have to deal with some kids that they probably ordinarily would try to get out really, really fast. So we have to talk about the preparedness of general hospitals to handle unusual pediatric volumes and acuities. And this is where I'm going to throw it to Rex. Rex, what do you think is the state in our state of pediatric preparedness among our general hospitals? And granted, not to say that children's hospitals have the best plans either. And honestly, children's hospitals have to plan to take care of adult patients. But in general, what do you think the state is of our general hospitals for taking care of unusual pediatric volumes and acuities?
Well, Lou, several thoughts come to mind. And I think that certainly, as one of my very wise mentors has told me for years and tried to stress to me, is we have no problems. What we have are opportunities. And I think that events like the ones we're talking about illustrate that we have a huge number of opportunities. And I think we have opportunities for all of the hospitals, including the children's hospitals, as well as the general hospitals, to evaluate what they are doing, try to look at them as objectively as possible with their abilities to meet anticipated needs. And then some of the things that have been mentioned by the other speakers here, I am like yourself, I couldn't agree with more, that issues such as taking honest assessments at current capabilities, trying to, as best possible, one of my friends defines genius as the to learn from others and to learn from prior things. And situations such as Hurricane Andrews, looking at the ones that came through Central Florida. I had 3 children in school in Orlando the year that all of the hurricanes came right through there back to back to back. I'm up here in the Panhandle in Pensacola where we got hit by Hurricane Ivan that nearly removed us off the map. And then subsequent to that, Katrina that was over in New Orleans that we got hit with the eastward side of the force of that as well. And all of these things, there were certainly huge amounts of lessons to be learned. A statement that was made by the incoming Florida Surgeon General, Dr. John Armstrong, that's going to be, hasn't even assumed that position yet. I think it's going to be coming into that in the next couple of weeks. But in a recent gathering with some of the Department of Health folks that he was going to be working with in the near future, was heard to make the comment that in regards to special needs shelters and things that he really conceptually has a little different opinion and a different view of that and thinks similar to what has been mentioned here, that for the short-term urgent emergent response type of thing that all of the shelters need to be able to set up and address the needs of all of the people, not for the long-term period, but for short-term types of things, because we're here talking about children now. We could just as easily be talking about the geriatric population. We could be talking about those that have handicaps and disabilities in regard to mobility. We could be talking about those needing oxygen. I mean, where do you draw the line on when to have X number of specialty shelters? And you begin to find that you've got 600 different types of specialty shelters, and it's impractical, and it's you're unable to do that. And so I think the preparation and the acknowledgement that, yes, children are different, they do have different needs, but they do coexist within the general population, and that particularly when it comes to disaster planning, we need to all figure that we are all in this together. Speaking of Hurricane Katrina, I'm reminded of the idea, reflecting back on some of the pictures that we may recall of the Children's Hospital there in New Orleans. And I know that is one of the plans of many of the general hospitals, is that the way they are going to handle pediatric needs is that plan A and plan B, and sometimes even down to plan C, is we're going to send them as quickly as possible to the Children's Hospital. Well, if people will remember what the status of the Children's Hospital was in New Orleans following Katrina, and the first two floors of the Children's Hospital were underwater, and the pictures you may recall had to do with the helicopters evacuating the patients off of the top of the Children's Hospital, so that the Children's Hospital, not only did it not serve as a resource, it was in fact one of the areas needing help and needing responders to come in there and help them meet the needs that existed within the Children's Hospital. Here in Pensacola, when Hurricane Ivan came through, Sacred Heart, where the Children's Hospital for the entire, not just here in Pensacola, but if you look at a map of Florida, that the Children's Hospital at Sacred Heart is the last Children's Hospital you will see as you head east until you get either to Jacksonville or you get down to Gainesville. So the entire northern part of Florida exists with the Children's Hospital here in Pensacola, and then the special needs abilities in Tallahassee at Tallahassee Memorial. So to think that the needs of entire regions of the state are going to be met by the local children's hospitals is an unrealistic expectation, and a very dangerous one to exist if that exists as plan A or plan B for any of the areas. So I think the reality is exactly as all of our speakers have suggested, is that these general hospitals, who on their routine modus operandi is to triage patients to the children's hospital, need to be recognizing that their plans need to, at least for a relatively short term, 48, 72 hours, maybe even 96 hours or so, include the fact that they may be the providers of some of those children's services, at least until transportation routes open back up and referral to other centers opens back up and those types of things.
And you know, Rex, the Disaster Preparedness Working Group for the EMSC Advisory Committee recently sent out a survey to all the EMS agencies and hospitals in the state. And we didn't get a good enough return to really say that we have any scientific conclusions, but the results that we did get surely supported our assumptions that a good number of EMS agencies and particularly hospitals probably are not up to snuff in planning for an unusual pediatric load. In some of the cases, the written comments were, oh, we never see pediatrics. If anybody walks in, we transfer them out as quickly as possible. How are they going to be able to prepare for the eventuality that they can transfer somebody out? What kind of components do we think that the general hospitals need to be thinking about in their hospital-wide disaster planning so that they can assure that they can take care of this unusual pediatric population?
Well, Lou, I think that's an excellent question, and it gets into a lot of the things that Jim and Dave yourself and many others have talked about, and I couldn't agree more. One of the other hats that I wear is I am the regional medical director for something within the state of Florida. A lot of our listeners will recognize is an agency called Children's Medical Services, and it is a division of the Department of Health that does deal specifically, as was mentioned earlier, with the subset of children with special health care needs. And CMS has also been designated by the state to be the agency that is in charge of dealing with and working with the various emergency planners, disaster planners, on meeting needs and planning for meeting the needs of all children, not just those on the Medicaid population, but all children with special health care needs and ways of doing that. And I think a huge part of that, as you all have mentioned, is preparing at home. It's evacuating early. It is planning early. It is realistically looking at what your capabilities are, and the likelihood is that you will be either severely impacted by a storm, in which case evacuation needs to be your plan, or the reality that perhaps you are in a area where the particular disaster, particularly if it's something like a hurricane and you do have some time to make arrangements, the chances are you will weather that fairly well, but it's going to take preparation. You need to get adequate fuel, for example, if you've got a generator at home, and you need to be making other preparations such as boarding windows and shuttering and doing those things. And as Jim and Dave said, you don't wait till the day the wind starts picking up to make those preparations. For other disasters and areas where those are not the case, then I think the general hospitals need to be involved with things such as community plans, and they need to do it realistically. I chuckled somewhat that we in our community here in Escambia County recently had a community-wide disaster plan, and it involved a couple of aircraft going down, and there was about, as I recall, about 40 children impacted in this disaster. And as it worked out, wouldn't you know it, that all 40 of the kids were either relatively little injured, or it worked out where it was just enough that they were all able to go to the children's hospital. I thought, this is not the way to plan and run a practice scenario. In my mind, and where I think it would have been most helpful to the community, would be to assume that the children's hospital, for whatever reason, it was the middle of RSV season or some of these other realities and they were full, or enough patients had already gotten to the children's hospital that that resource is now taken off the table, and putting it during practice scenarios and some of these tabletop exercises and things where the general hospitals have an opportunity again ahead of time to work through some of these things, and let's say playing some of what-if scenarios. What if we really did have to take care of children? And let's start looking at things like our triage capability, recognizing that in most disasters, that while there are a lot of people impacted, fortunately, there are relatively few that need the highest levels of health care, and that a lot of them need more basic things like simply some shelter and some power and some safety from looting or whatever it might be, and things that could be met other than by the hospital. But because of the fact hospitals are seen as safe havens, and they are seen as usually being very structurally sound and having resources available and that type of thing, what we have learned from some of the past hurricane experiences and these other things is a lot of the general population even self-delivers, if you will, to the hospitals, not so much because they're needing critical hospital services or even lower intensity hospital services. They're needing food and water and shelter and safety and those types of things. And I think that's where some of the basic preparations like security and effective triage and some of those things come into play, so that the people that truly need hospital services, and certainly those that truly need higher levels of hospital services, are the ones that have access to those resources and things. I think the other place this was learned was during the SARS episodes back in Toronto and things a number of years ago, when part of the most effective part of healthcare was the security that actually arrived to lock down the hospital, so to speak, that said, if you need this, you will have access to it, but not simply because there's a panic taking place and people see the hospitals as a safe place to go.
And Rex, you know, you mentioned that your community had this disaster drill that had a lot of pediatric patients. I think that there are many opportunities to integrate children into disaster drills. I mentioned it already for EMS, but it needs to be done in these community-wide drills, and it needs to be done in hospital disaster drills too. You know, a hospital might say, okay, we're not going to include kids in our, you know, JCO, Joint Commission disaster drill because, you know, we're not going to see a whole lot of kids. But it's exactly the circumstances where you should be putting kids into the disaster drills, because it's in disasters when you may have that unusual number and types of kids presenting to your hospital. You know, you have to drill on how to deal with them. So that's one really, really important part of the disaster planning on the part of hospitals, is to integrate kids and even integrate family considerations. Again, you know, what are you going to do to help with reunification when kids are separated from the rest of their family? How are you going to handle the anxious family members who are coming in? Is my child at your hospital? Is he there? Is she there? And then the media also, that, you know, always gets attracted to kids who are in distress. So many aspects that can be practiced in advance through hospital drills if you simply think to add them to the drills in your basic planning.
Yes, Lou, I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly right. And as all of you all have said, that a lot of this is anticipation, it's consideration, it's kind of trying to envision and do some worst-case scenario planning, and particularly when it is nothing more than an exercise. And that's the time to learn where the flaws are, where the weaknesses are, where the systems are going to break down, and encouraging these hospitals that do not do this on a routine daily basis is even more of a reason to do it during these disaster exercises and things. That one of the things that I think we all have learned from these events is that the usual norm is not going to be the scenarios, that business as usual is not going to exist. And so the idea that, oh, well, we don't need to do with that because we send them over to the children's hospital, that needs to not be one of the allowed scenarios in these exercises and things. And the only thing that's going to happen in doing it that way is they're going to be better prepared, better equipped. And we just mentioned with our EMS providers themselves in the field that you improve their confidence and you improve their response capabilities by exposing them to children at any level, even giving immunizations, going to schools and interacting with them, et cetera. And so the idea that during exercises you would throw some children into the mix improves people's confidence that when they find themselves having to face that in true disaster scenarios, it is less unsettling, as well as being better prepared for as well.
And, you know, we were talking about integrating kids into the community disaster response and planning, and talking about EMS agencies working with, say, schools to provide children to be victims in a disaster drill. And then EMS takes those patients, those mock patients, from the scene of the disaster, let's say a tornado striking a school, and goes to the hospital with those kids. And I think in those cases, part of the drill needs to be insisting on sending children to the hospitals that ordinarily would not get children. Because if you practice the way you do every day, then, you know, you're going to be caught behind the eight ball when that circumstance happens, when those resources aren't available. So, you know, when you have those community-wide disasters, Rex already mentioned, oh, gee, all the kids wound up going to the children's hospital. Well, part of the drills on the EMS side should be forcing those hospitals that think that they're not going to get patients to get patients and find out where the holes are in their planning.
Well, you know, Lou, the reality is that, you know, for us, it would, in that scenario, would be going to the north, going up to Shands and other hospitals to the north. But what that's going to do to me is taking resources. Shands is almost an hour away. So I am going to be forced to take the patients within our community to our local hospitals of all ages and basically of all conditions, because we don't have the resources to send that many out of the area. You know, we're going to need to maximize our resources locally. So quite frankly, they're going to end up at the local hospitals.
And what do you think the pucker factor is going to be at those hospitals when they realize that they're going to be getting those patients and they haven't anticipated that ever happening?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to say the least, but, you know, we certainly don't have any choice. And then, you know, once the winds die down and the weather gets better and we have adequate resources, then certainly we're going to be able to then, you know, transfer those patients, minor as well as critical, you know, to the appropriate facility. But again, you know, given the conditions and given the volume of patients and the ability to take anybody, you know, a great distance, we're going to be, again, taking those patients to the closest hospital, and we wouldn't have much of a choice in that scenario.
And, you know, we're not preaching here that every hospital should be able to take care of a very critically ill or injured child for prolonged periods of time. We are talking about a fairly sophisticated response system in the way of local responses and local resources, but even more so as access improves, incoming resources from the state, regional, and federal level. So, you know, eventually there's going to come a time when those children will be able to be moved up to facilities that have more sophisticated capabilities. All we're asking for is the initial ability to take care of the people in their community. The disaster stays in your community, and it is the community's responsibility to be able to provide that first response capability. Is that not right?
Lou, could I add two more points here real quickly? One is a tremendous resource available as far as the hospital aspect of things is a gentleman by the name of John Wilgus. W-I-L-G-I-S, and John works full-time with the Florida Hospital Association. I suspect that many of the listeners are already familiar with John and the work that he does. He is in charge of disaster preparation and planning for the Florida Hospital Association, working with all of the member hospitals. John has worked with me and with some other organizations with the specific interest of improving pediatric considerations throughout the Florida Hospital Association member organizations. And I think he would have a lot of resources available, a lot of insight and interest in helping organizations try to improve in this area. The other one is a gentleman named Dr. Andy Rux. It's R-U-C-K-S. Dr. Rux is a PhD with the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. He and a number of associates throughout the Southeast are formulating and structuring an organization called the Southeast Regional Pediatric Disaster Surge Response Network. Unfortunately, it has a very long name, but it also has a very important role, I think, of working within Florida and all the other states here in the Southeast of trying to build collaborative networks in being able to respond to, plan for, and meet the needs of communities in addressing pediatric needs in the face of disasters.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Rex. You know, there are a lot of resources out there, and the Florida EMSC program will be putting some lists together of resources that are available both for EMS agencies and for hospitals in their consideration for planning for kids in the event of disasters. You know, we're basically saying that there's a problem here, and the goal of Florida EMSC is whenever we identify a problem, we try to do what we can to provide solutions. So there are a lot of resources available. We will make those available through FLEMSCOM, which for the Florida EMS people, you're familiar with that. For those of you who are not in the state of Florida, we will also make those available potentially through the PDU website. One way or the other, we'll let you know where it is. We'll let you know on the Facebook page too, where you can access those resources. So what we've done today is to try to build a picture of the state of Florida for the preparedness for taking care of kids on behalf of EMS agencies and hospitals in the state of Florida. Now, Florida, I think, possibly has among the better disaster planning of all levels, just because we have a lot of practice at it. So we have some fairly sophisticated systems. That's not true everywhere. But whoever you are, wherever you work, in the interest of taking care of the kids, you need to know what the disasters are that are more prone to happen in your area. And we're asking you, please, to go to your agency, whoever you work with, and to try to find some information on how well your agency, be it a hospital, an EMS agency, or anyone else, how well your agency is set up to take care of an unusual volume of pediatric patients. This may be something that your agency will use once a decade. On the other hand, it may be something that you're going to use it once a year. Whenever you have to use it, it better be good, because the kids are going to be depending on us and their families will be depending on us as well. So I'd just like to go around to the panel and just in the interest of any wise words, any additional resources that you'd like to offer, go to each one of you, let you have a last word. And then also, if you would, please let us know an email address, perhaps, where people can get a hold of you if they have questions. Let's start with Dave.
I would just remind everybody that while planning takes a lot of effort, it is the act of doing the planning that is actually the benefit, not the resulting paper. You've got to go through the process. Anyone that wants to get in touch with me, my email address is Dave, D-A-V-E dot Freeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N, at OCFL.net.
Thanks, Dave. Jim?
You bet. You know, if you take care of kids well on a daily basis, the chances are you're going to be prepared to care for them in disasters. You want to make sure that you have adequate equipment, the training, and you want to include them in all your planning. So, you know, the sun is shining. It's nice out right now. Hurricane season is still a little ways off. So review the plans. Take the necessary steps to be prepared, and don't forget kids in the planning. And my email address is jjudge, J-U-D-G-E, at lakeems.org.
Thank you, Jim. Rex?
I just echo the comments of the other speakers here of do some objective self-assessment of current capabilities. Include children in the planning, regardless of what organization and what population you serve. Under usual times, you need to assume you're going to be involved with the provision of some level of care for some period of time to the pediatric population, and participate in the planning and the actual enactment of exercises and things involving children to further identify opportunities to improve the services we provide to the community that depends on us. The best email to get up with me is Rex, R-E-X, underscore, Northup, and it is N-O-R-T-H-U-P, at D-O-H dot state, S-T-A-T-E, dot F-L dot U-S. Apologize for the length of that email. That's part of state government.
Thank you, Rex. And I'd like to remind our listeners that you can reach me at Lou Romig, that's L-O-U-R-O-M-I-G, at Bell South, that's B-E-L-L-S-O-U-T-H.net. And then my website is www.jumpstarttriage.com. Now, if you go to the other lectures page on that website, you'll find a lot of my disaster lectures, including a good amount of information on family disaster planning, as well as pediatric planning for disasters for EMS agencies. You're more than welcome to go on that website and download anything that's there, including anything that you need to know about Jumpstart Triage. And I'd just like to remind you that for those of you who are in the state of Florida, the Florida EMSC program is here to serve the EMS providers and our citizens and visitors. You know, the EMSC Advisory Council or Committee and the EMSC program is made up of a diverse number of healthcare providers and representatives of agencies within our state. And we work interactively, interagency-wise, to try to assure that the needs of children are being met and that the needs of those who care for our children in our state are being met as well. Anything that the EMSC program can do for anyone in the state of Florida, we are more than happy to do. And indeed, we expand that outside of the state of Florida as well. We are here to be of service. If you are not in Florida, but you are in the United States, every single state, territory, and region in the United States, including Guam and some of the Pacific Islands, have an EMSC program. So if you want to find out more about your EMSC program, simply go online and do a search for EMSC and then your state or region's name, and you'll find a wealth of resources there. In addition, if you search under National Resource Center, EMSC, that will take you to the PED Prepared website, which is a relatively new disaster information clearinghouse that's housed in the federal EMSC program and has right now over 500 resources that are probably going to be of use to you. Kyle, I'd like to thank you for partnering with Florida EMSC for this podcast. We hope to join you in partnering for additional podcasts. I think we have a lot more to say about disasters. We have a lot more to say about anything that has to take care of kids and emergencies, and we appreciate your partnership with us.
Lou, I wish to thank you. I wish to thank Rex, Dave, and Jim for joining us on this episode of the PDU, a special episode for the Florida Emergency Medical Services for Children for EMS Week. This should be up right around Wednesday of the week for that. So, folks, just remember, you know, one of the biggest things about disaster management is being prepared, and for in terms of kids, being prepared to deal with kids and understanding how to assess them. So for my panel today, myself, Kyle David Bates, you can find me over at Kyle David. Bates.com. You can find me here at PDU, PEDI-U.com. We'll have some resources up there for you. You can also find us on Twitter, PDU. You can also find me on Twitter at ImageMedic for that. And also give us a shout out over on our Facebook page, PDU, for that. So for the panel and myself, have a good night and remember, stay safe.
Hold on to you as long as I can.